Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Tuesday, March 12th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Doug Kretzinger and Scott Splevic. And here's Scott for our first story.
Thank you, Doug. Our top story is entitled Closed Session in Dispute. Davenport officials object to auditor's request. It's written by Sarah Watts, another Quad City Times. The city of Davenport is arguing in court that it should not have to turn over recordings of closed meetings to the state auditor's office as it investigates the city's settlements with former employees, citing attorney-client privilege. State Auditor Rob Sand announced in January his office would review the city's settlements with three now former employees, including a $1.6 million payment to former city administrator Corey Spiegel that were not voted on in public session until months after agreements were signed. As part of that investigation, Sand's office issued a subpoena for several city records, including the meeting recordings for several closed city council sessions leading up to the announcement of Spiegel's departure, copies of emails, memorandums, payments, and other documents discussing proposed settlements, and settlement agreements involving Spiegel and administrative employees Samantha Torres and Tiffany Thorndike, their employment agreements, and final signed settlement agreements. The auditor's office, in its response filed in court, says Iowa Code states the auditor's office, while conducting an audit, shall at all times have access to all information at all times used by an audited entity in the performance of its duties. Iowa Code stipulates if materials are required to be kept confidential, the auditor's office should still have access to the information or records, but will maintain the confidentiality subject to the same penalties. The public interest in providing the records to the auditor outweighs the assertion of privilege in this case, the auditor's office argues. Given the confidentiality protections of 11.42, there is no danger of unauthorized disclosure of confidential records. Attorneys from Lane and Waterman, in a letter to the state auditor's office dated February the 15th, objected to the state auditor's request for closed session recordings, but supplied other documents requested by the state office. In the letter attached to the city's motion, attorney Brett Marshall wrote that the city's defense strategies against pending and threatened lawsuits were discussed at closed sessions and disclosure would be disastrous. The city is currently engrossed in numerous pending and threatened lawsuits. These pending and threatened lawsuits, including the city's entire defense strategies, have been discussed with its attorneys at its closed session meetings, Marshall's letter states. As I'm sure you would agree, a waiver of the city's privilege with regard to these closed sessions would be disastrous and irreparably harm the city in its ability to defend itself in these lawsuits. A court hearing is scheduled for March 25th. The city is arguing the court should order a modification of the auditor's office subpoena, and the auditor's office is arguing the court should order the city to comply fully with the subpoena. In separate records suit, city opposes Iowa FOI council intervention. In a separate legal case, the city is opposing intervention by a nonprofit agency that advocates for open records and government transparency. In the case, the city asked the courts to decide whether Spiegel's demand letter should be released as a public record. The city, through its attorneys, argued the Iowa Freedom of Information Council did not follow civil procedure and had only an indirect interest in the outcome of the case. The FOIC, in response, filed its own FOIA request for the Spiegel demand letter and argued that its members, including the Quad City Times, do have a direct interest in the outcome of the case. The FOIC has argued that public accounting of what led to a $1.6 million payment using taxpayer funds to a former city employee outweighs Spiegel's privacy concerns. The council is aware of at least two others who also requested the letter, including the Quad City Times and attorney Mike Malloy. So it is notable that the city selected the requester, Dr. David Ezra Sidran, a non-attorney citizen who was the least likely to have the resources and experience to defend against a declaratory judgment action, and the most injured by getting hauled into court as a defendant simply by requesting access to a public record from a government entity, the FOIC filing stated. Thorndike and Torres also have motioned to intervene in the suit. The city also opposes their motions to intervene, saying the suit is asking the court to decide on Spiegel's letter, not Thorndike's or Torres's records. A hearing on the motions to intervene is set for March the 29th.
Continuing on the front page, Evans Jr. found guilty of first-degree murder is an article written by Anthony. The judge found Glenn G. Evans Jr. guilty of first-degree murder for the 2023 shooting death of another man. Evans, 19, of Rock Island, faced a single count of first-degree murder. According to court records, authorities allege he killed Xavion A. McNair, 19, on August 19 of 2023, at a house party in the 2000 block of 33rd Street in Rock Island. McNair died on the way to the hospital, police said previously. Evans, shot in the leg, was treated and released. Evans opted for a bench trial, so Judge Daniel P. Dalton, not a jury, had to decide Evans' culpability. Testimony began on February 27 and concluded March 1. Dalton has been deliberating since then. Dalton announced the verdict at an afternoon hearing. The families, friends, and loved ones of McNair and Evans filled the gallery. Sentencing has been scheduled for May 17. After the hearing, Dalton said there will be a pre-sentence investigation performed ahead of the sentence hearing. Such investigations are designed to develop a background report on a defendant to assist a judge in determining the appropriate sentence. Defense attorney Kelvin McCabe of the Rock Island County Public Defender's Office said he expects to appeal. At trial, McCabe contended that his client acted in self-defense. Assistant State's Attorney Jesse Brockways argued there was no justification for the killing. On the overview, Brockway put numerous witnesses on the stand, including teens who attended the party, Rock Island police officers, and forensics experts. McCabe cross-examined the state's witnesses, and Evans elected to testify in his own defense. When the shooting began, Evans and McNair were arguing over a gun, according to trial testimony. McNair apparently took it from Evans, who was trying to get it back. Both men were armed when the confrontation occurred. Authorities recovered the gun that evidence indicates killed McNair. The gun witnesses said McNair had was not recovered. Accounts, however, of how the shooting started differed between the defense and prosecution. State witnesses testified that they did not see McNair make any threatening moves and did not see the first shot fired. One, a juvenile, said she heard the shot come from behind her and that Evans was standing behind her. Brockway told Dalton during the final day of testimony that there is no evidence that McNair aimed or fired a gun. Evans testified that McNair acted aggressively to ward him and shot first, hitting Evans. Evans said he then started shooting back as they both ran from the room, McNair in front. McNair still had the gun in his hand, so Evans kept shooting until he saw McNair had dropped the gun. Well, Brockway also played security video footage from the front of the house. The footage recovered by police included the shooting's final moments. The camera covered the resident's front porch and stairs, the front yard, and nearby street. There is a loud bang. People scream and flee the house. Then there are more bangs. McNair tumbles down the front porch stairs and comes to rest in the yard. He drops what police identified as a probable handgun. A gunman, whom police identified as Evans, stands over him and fires several more shots. Once he stops shooting, the gunman picks up the dropped object, then walks out of the camera's view a few moments later. Evans returned to the house while police were still on the scene after the shooting, according to authorities. Evans' testimony included that when he confronted McNair about the missing handgun, he saw that McNair had it under his arm. Evans said he had one of his father's pistols, which Evans found in the glove box of the car while looking for the missing handgun. Evans is the son of Rock Island County Republican Central Committee Chairman Glenn J. Evans, Sr., according to previous reporting. Evans, Sr. also testified at the trial. When Evans, Jr. left the yard after the shooting, he encountered his father, both said during the trial. Evans, Sr. testimony included that he'd received phone calls that something had happened and that someone had taken his son's gun. He went to the neighborhood where the party was happening. Just after arriving, he heard the shots. Soon after, he met his son. Both he and Evans, Jr. told the court Evans, Jr. returned his father's firearm to Evans, Sr. Shortly after the shooting, Evans, Sr. turned that pistol into the Rock Island Police, according to testimony. Evans, Jr. told police he put the firearm he took from McNair in his car. Before announcing his verdict, Dalton gave an overview of how he interpreted the trial evidence. The judge said he thought McNair did shoot first. The wound on Evans' leg was not consistent with a self-inflicted gunshot, but that Evans, not McNair, was the aggressor. There was testimony that Evans had threatened McNair, Dalton said. Witnesses also said Evans had a gun in his hand and was pointing it in McNair's direction, though it was also pointed toward the ground. Once Evans did that, McNair was well within his rights to shoot. Dalton also noted testimony and evidence that when Evans returned to the party just before the shooting, he left his car running and was wearing gloves. While reviewing the video, Dalton said he saw the porch. Evans could see the gun dropped by McNair but continued to fire. Dalton also referenced Evans Jr. testimony that put the gun he'd taken from McNair in his car. That gun disappeared, Dalton said. The judge said he thought that pistol was made to disappear. It didn't go missing on its own.
Thank you, Doug. Our next story is part of the Timeless Tickets series, where the Quad City Times is aiming to find the most notable concerts in the Quad Cities every year from 1960 to today. And it's entitled Journey Van Halen Performed at Rockfest. Rockfest on Credit Island was 4 years in the making. This is written by Gavin Hannevold. Credit Island will rock and roll. That's what the headlines in the Quad City Times read on July 14, 1978. 2 days later, the long-awaited Rockfest on Credit Island came to fruition. This fest was 4 years in the making. Multiple promoters tried and failed to get approval to bring rock and roll to the outdoor space on Credit Island, but Midwest Concerts was the group to finally get it done. The lineup was even bigger than surely many local rock and roll fans could have anticipated. The headliner was established rock act, the Doobie Brothers, who had brought a crowd of more than 10,000 people to the Mississippi Valley Fairgrounds just a few years earlier. Little needs to be said of their fame, wrote Scott Noker in the Quad City Times Festival Preview. Then there was Atlanta Rhythm Section, a southern rock group, in the wake of their second top 10 Billboard hit, Imaginary Lover, released earlier that year. The group had spent much of the summer of 1978 playing festivals worldwide, sharing stages with Aerosmith, Tom Petty, and the Heartbreakers, and more, before coming to Credit Island. Somehow, with the gift of hindsight, the opening bands managed to be the biggest deal of all. First off, there was Journey, who had already played with Kiss a few years before at Davenport's RKO Orpheum Theater. At this time, Journey was a band on the rise. It was their first full year with new frontman Steve Perry, and the group had charted their first Billboard Hot 100 hits Wheel in the Sky and Anytime. Just 3 years later, they'd be one of the biggest rock bands in the world. Then, there was the smallest band on the lineup, Van Halen. The group had just released their first album, the self-titled Van Halen, which featured emerging hits like You Really Got Me and Runnin' with the Devil. The Quad City Times reportedly described the group as raunch and roll, noting that their style was a perfect fit for an outdoor rock fest. Well, as long as they can get up on the stage. The show was scheduled to start on July 16, 1978 at noon. By 6 a.m., there were already thousands in line. That was around the same time Van Halen's equipment finally got in from their show the previous night in Cleveland. With such a late arrival, the entire schedule was thrown off kilter. They didn't take the stage until 2 p.m. "Okay, let's really ham it up," Van Halen frontman David Lee Roth said to his bandmates before taking the stage. After 2 hours of waiting, or eight for the most loyal concertgoers, Van Halen only played for a half hour. Asked by Noker about the short set, Roth was tight-lipped, blaming the late equipment rival. "My department is sex, drugs, and rock and roll," he said. Tickets to the Mississippi River Jam sold for $10 in advance or $12.50 at the door. Over 25,000 are estimated to have attended. Those who persevered through the two-hour delay before Van Halen had to wait once more. It took a full hour to set up the stage for Journey. By the time the California Rockers took the stage, they played for just 45 minutes. As they left the stage, temperatures approached 90 degrees. Over 25,000 pounds of ice had already been sold, Noker reported. No outside beverages were allowed to be brought in, and there were no alcoholic beverages sold at the fest either. As the heat went up, distributor Coca-Cola was dishing drinks in overdrive. Atlanta Rhythm Section's set brought even more heat. Their 50-minute concert was interrupted after some of their equipment caught on fire. When it was repaired, the crowd burst into applause. Because of all the heat and delays, a few thousand attendees left the show early and never even saw the Doobie Brothers, who played a less than an hour set, Noker reported. Many of their hits were left on the chopping block. But during the set, the Doobie Brothers drummer Keith Knutson praised the crowd's tranquility. "The City Fathers are looking at you tonight," he told the crowd. "The police are happy, we're happy, and we're going to be back to do this again." He was right on all fronts. The Doobies came back to the Quad Cities to play the Mississippi Valley Fair in 2006, and during the long, controversial first Mississippi River Jam, the police were indeed happy. All in all, there were zero violent arrests and zero drug overdoses reported. A few fans knocked over a stage barrier as the day started, and that's about all that was reported to the Times. "We haven't even had two of them out there fighting," a spokesperson from the Scott County Sheriff's Office told Noker and the Times. "This crowd could have just walked all over this place, but they didn't." The biggest issue of the fest was parking. Around 40 cars were towed for parking illegally. Those who parked illegally paid a different price, $2 to park in the closest lot. Those attendees later learned that the show's promoters had no authorization to charge for those spots, and a police commission told the Times that they suspected the parking lot salespeople were scalpers not associated with the show's promoter. Another problem, like with many of the rock fests that came before, was the garbage. Wayne Boyer, then the director of Davenport Park Systems, told the Quad City Times weeks later that he'd be reluctant to let another rock show come to Credit Island after considerable damage came to the park. Boyer said that the grass on the island would take a year to grow back. The Mississippi River Jam came back the next summer, but in a new setting. Credit Island may not rock and roll, but Davenport still will.
Thank you, Scott. Page 3, local section. MIDA receives Officer of the Year. I think that's pronounced right. MIDDAGH. Muscatine, Iowa Association of Women Police Officer, Area Officer. Award Area Officer. A Muscatine police officer won the 2024 Iowa Association of Women's Police Officer of the Year Award. Officer Cassie MIDA won the award, the Muscatine Police Department announced last week. MIDA said she is thankful for the award and recognition but felt completely shocked about receiving it. Quote, "I obviously did not expect it at all, though I kind of had an idea when I saw my entire family walk into the room. My chief was also staring at me, but it was definitely still shocking and exciting," end quote, she said. This is the third award that MIDA has received over the past year. In 2023, she also received two life-saving awards from the city. This also is the third time in the past 4 years that a Muscatine officer has won the Iowa Association of Women's Police Officer of the Year Award. The recognition, she said, means everything to her. Quote, "It's kind of a cliche in the police officer world that we all get into policing to help people, but that's generally why I became a police officer. I wanted to help my community and show my kid that where we live is a safe place, and I play a role in keeping it safe," she said. She went on, the fact that my department allows that type of recognition and holds their officers up is just amazing. It gives us really good feeling," end quote. Asked about the previous life-saving instances, Middaugh said the first award came after an open line 911 call where she could hear a female resident trying to get someone to wake up. She arrived on scene as the only officer and found a male who was unresponsive with no heartbeat and wasn't breathing. She began performing CPR until medics arrived. Quote, "By the time medical got here, he was alert and responsive and breathing on his own, so that was a good ending to that one," end quote, she said. The second instance had similar circumstances, although she and a fellow officer were able to get more information about the incident prior to arriving on scene, where they found a male who was unresponsive and without a heartbeat. Once there, she and the other officer supplied a couple of shocks to the patient through an AED machine in addition to performing chest compressions until medical got there to apply further life-saving measures. Prior to becoming a police officer, she first worked at Allsteel for 10 years. While there, she was trained as a first responder, performing chest compressions and other life-saving measures on fellow employees when needed. It doesn't happen often as police officer, but it's something I'm trained and comfortable doing," she said. She also worked as a 911 dispatcher for Muscatine County before finally deciding to become an officer about 2 years ago. With three awards under her belt, she said she hopes to continue doing her job as an officer, all while focusing on some of her biggest police-related passions. "These passions are community policing, taking the time to go out and into the community and help humanize the badge through local events and connecting with residents and mental health awareness. I've taken a couple of courses in crisis intervention training, which is essential where someone is having a mental health or substance abuse crisis," she said. "I'm trained in recognizing these instances and know that they are in a crisis situation, and that's something I want to bring more recognition to. The fact that mental health is so prevalent in our community," she said. She also took a moment to thank her fellow officers and supervisors at the police department. Her supervisors, she said, are amazing and are always offering encouragement. "The fact that three female officers from the Muscatine Police Department have won this Officer of the Year award feels like a direct correlation to the supervisors that we have and the tools that we are given," she said.
Yoga Studio coming to Moline. Sanctuary Studios will be open by the end of the month. It's written by Gretchen Teske of the Quad City Times. A new yoga studio with an emphasis on accessibility and belonging is opening soon in Moline. Sanctuary Studios is set to open later this month on the second floor of the former Scottish Rite Cathedral, now the Spotlight Theater building at 1800 7th Avenue. The space was formerly occupied by The Market, a collection of small businesses selling in one space. Founder Sarah Stevens has turned the 2,000-square-foot room into an inviting studio where all body types are welcomed, she said. Her own journey with yoga started in 2011 when she tried out a hot yoga class. "I remember feeling ridiculous at the time because I was in all-black athletic pants and a giant T-shirt. I just had no idea what I was doing, but I walked out and I could wring my shirt out," she said. "But I went back because there was something about it." Fast forward 13 years, and Stevens said the continuous practice and movement in yoga has been a consistent anchor in her own healing relationship with her body. Now she is offering it to others. Sanctuary Studios has been something Stevens has thought about for the last couple of years, she said. Once a year, she takes a trip to Maine and practices at a yoga studio there. The energy and safety of the room is where she had an epiphany about her next journey, one she made once she made it back to the Quad Cities. They're building community in a way that I want to, and in the place that raised me, she said. It was more than just dropping into a class. There was a connection to each other. After walking along the beach, she gave the name a lot of thought when Sanctuary Studios just came to her. Sanctuary means a place of safety, and I love that idea that sanctuary doesn't necessarily mean the absence of a threat, but a presence of connection, she said. That's the kind of safety that I want to try and build. Classes will be held at 9 a.m. Monday through Friday and at 6:30 p.m. Monday through Thursday. On Saturday mornings at 10:30, she will teach some somatic succession, a type of yoga that helps stimulate brain-muscle connection to the body. Those interested can sign up online, where a prompt will also request a donation. Sanctuary will offer pay-what-you-can classes, Stevens said, to promote the idea of community care. We all go through seasons where we have enough, more than enough, and not enough, she said. I want Sanctuary to be a space that has room for all of those seasons as they move through our lives. The studio has one level of membership, the Outer Circle. For $99 a month, a discount on workshops and merchandise in addition to helping build the financial foundation of the studio. Once the studio reaches 40 members, Stevens will add more classes. Teachers at the studio also will be paid above the market rate price in order to afford them a living wage and doing what they love, she said. Those interested in taking classes only need to dress comfortably. Mats will be available for rent and water will be provided. The grand opening of Sanctuary Studios is set for Tuesday, March the 19th, with the first full week of classes set for the week after.
And here's an article. It's called Bill to Help Iowa's Nursing Homes Manage Cost Advances, written by Aaron Murphy of the Liz Gazette Des Moines Bureau. A proposal to cap what staffing agencies can charge for the help of temporary health care workers, which Iowa's nursing homes turn to as a means of addressing employee shortages, is being considered by state lawmakers. The proposal's supporters say staffing agencies charge so much for temporary nurses that it places a financial burden on nursing homes and other health care facilities. But the proposal also has been met with caution from the staffing agencies, which insist that billing rates that spiked during the COVID-19 pandemic have been gradually returning to pre-pandemic levels, and warn that capping rates would only make the healthcare worker shortage even worse. Under the proposal, payment rates for nursing services provided by staffing agencies could be no more than 150% of the statewide average paid that previous year. The proposal was introduced by majority Republicans in the Iowa House and passed out of that chamber with a strong bipartisan support. It is now being considered in the Iowa Senate, where the proposal went through its first legislative hearing in that chamber Monday at the Iowa Capitol. Quote, "The stress in the long-term care industry is very real. I think everybody understands that," end quote, said Jason Schultz, a Republican from Schleswig, who ran the subcommittee hearing Monday, told reporters after the meeting, quote, "I do believe we are going to have a very robust exchange of ideas on this one, but that indicates just how much money is at stake on one hand and how difficult the long-term care industry is on the other," end quote. Iowa's nursing homes are losing money. Had it already been in place, the proposed legislation would save the industry $22 million this year, according to the testimony of Brent Willett, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Iowa Health Care Association. The bill, House File 2391, previously passed the Iowa House on an 80-17 vote. Schleswig and fellow Republican Senator Don Driscoll from Williamsburg advanced it out of subcommittee Monday, making it eligible for consideration by the full Senate Workforce Committee. Schultz said the goal is to at least pass the bill out of the committee in order for it to qualify for this week's legislative deadline and remain eligible for consideration. And so, good time to tell you that you are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. It's time to turn to the obituaries, and Scott, I'm going to turn it over to obituaries.
All right, I'll start with the pendings. First, we have Jacob L. Brewster, age 52, of Maquoketa, Iowa, who passed away on Saturday afternoon, March the 9th, at home. Arrangements are pending at Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. Next, we have Tanner Brundage, age 25, who died on Saturday, March the 9th. Arrangements are pending at Carson Celebration Life of Center in Maquoketa. John L. Kilberg, age 74, and Donnell J. Kilberg, age 70, of Sproggville, Iowa, a devoted couple whose love and kindness touched many hearts, passed away together on March the 6th, 2024. John experienced a medical emergency while Donnell's passing followed due to injuries sustained in an automobile accident near Highway 13 and Travis Road in Marion, Iowa. Terry Ottens, age 75, of Fulton, Illinois, died Friday, March the 8th, at his home. Arrangements are being handled by Bosma Renke's funeral home in Fulton, Illinois. Estella E. Carlson, age 97, of Davenport, passed away Saturday, March the 9th, at her home. Arrangements are pending at Rafferty Funeral Home in Moline, Illinois. Charles E. Crocker, age 85, of Andalusia, Illinois, passed away on Monday, March the 11th, at his home. Arrangements are being handled by Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Milan, Illinois. Carol J. Morehouse, age 86, of Coal Valley, Illinois, died Sunday, March the 10th, at Allure of the Quad Cities in Moline. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory in Moline, Illinois. Charles Charlie Poor, 20, of Moline, died Sunday, March the 10th, as a result of an accidental drowning while on spring break in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory in Moline, Illinois. Maria Morales, age 92, of Rock Island, Illinois, died Monday, March the 11th, at Unity Point Health, Trinity, Rock Island. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory in Moline. Vicki L. Vanalstein, or Vanalstein, V-A-N-A-L-S-T-I-N-E, age 69, of Moline, Illinois, died Monday, March the 11th, at home. Cremation will be directed by Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. Travis Gray, age 28, of Moline, passed away Sunday, March 10th, at UP Trinity Rock Island. Arrangements pending at Rafferty Funeral Home in Moline. And funeral services for Lillian Joan Kincaid, age 85, of Silvis, Illinois, will be 10 a.m. Thursday, March 14th, at the Van Ho Funeral Home in East Moline, Illinois. Burial will be in Greenview Memorial Gardens, East Moline. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, March 13th, at the funeral home. Mrs. Kincaid passed away Sunday, March the 10th, at her home. Further arrangements are pending at the funeral home.
Karen Carlson, C-A-R-L-S-E-N, of Comanche. Karen A. Carlson, 79, passed away Saturday, March 9, at her home. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday the 16th at Comanche Chapel, Snell's Oring Funeral Homes and Crematory. Burial will be in the Rose Hill Cemetery. Several serving as pallbearers will be Matthew Althaus, Mike Johnson, Jim Soule, and Ryan Veenstra. Visitation will be Friday from 4 to 6 at the funeral home. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting her obituary at snellzorning.com. Karen Ann Fletcher was born on July 29, 1944, in Clinton, daughter of Mervyn and Emily Holgerson Fletcher. She was a 62 graduate of Clinton High School. She married Dennis Carlson on September 23 of 1961 in DeWitt. He passed away March 13, 2019. Karen was an insurance agent with her husband for many years. Karen enjoyed gardening, traveling, crocheting, and beading. Karen is survived by her children, Dennis, Karen, Lars Carlson of Kill Devil Hills, North Carolina, and Paula spouse Corey, K-O-R-Y, Slade of LaGrange, Texas, 5 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren, and her beloved dog, Ginger. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband, 1 brother, 2 sisters. Memorials can be made to the American Lung Association. And our other one today is for Blake Chapman. 38 of Davenport, passed away unexpectedly on Wednesday, March 6th at his home. Funeral services will be 5 p.m. Tuesday, March 14th at the Thursday, March 14th at the Runge Mortuary in Davenport. Visitation will be held 2 hours prior to the service from 3 to 5 p.m. Thursday, March 14th, 2024. Also at the Runge Mortuary. After services, the family encourages everyone to join them at Frick's Tap, 1402 West 3rd, St. Davenport, or 3rd Street, Davenport, at 52802 for a drink in remembrance of Blake. Online condolences may be expressed at therungemortuary.com. Blake was born in Santa Ana, California on April 16, 1985, graduated from Moline High School. On July 25, 2020, Blake married the life of his life, Tiffany Chapman. He worked the love of his life. He worked at XPAC in Milan, Illinois, as a team lead for the paint department. Blake was a devoted father and loved spending time with his family. He was passionate for music, cooking, watching 80s and 90s movies, and coaching baseball. Blake enjoyed playing golf and going to watch his children's extracurricular activities. Blake will be missed dearly by his wife, Tiffany, children Keegan, Kaylin, and Kylie, his mother, Brenda Chapman of Moline, Illinois, his father, Philip Chapman of Des Moines, brothers Brian, spouse Karen Chapman of Florida, Taylor Chapman of Colorado, sisters Carrie, Phil Noriega, spouse Chapman of Wisconsin, and Raylan Chapman of Colorado, and a nephew, Kyler, K-U-Y-L-E-R, of Arizona. Blake is preceded in death by his maternal and paternal grandparents and his uncle, Jerry Chapman.
Now we'll move on to the opinion page of the Quad City Times, and I'll read this opinion entitled, "If Only Congress Would Focus on the Deficit That Matters." This is written by Carl W. Smith, who is a Bloomberg columnist and assistant professor of economics at the University of North Carolina. All the fear-mongering in Washington over the $1.5 trillion federal budget deficit hides a truth few politicians would admit. That hefty headline number you hear so much about is an unreliable measure of U.S. fiscal health. Savvy economists prefer what's known as the primary deficit, which is the overall shortfall minus what the government spends each year on interest payments. At $637 billion, this measure is smaller, less frightening, in line with recent history, and more important, shrinking, having narrowed from $1 trillion in 2023. It's a shame that lawmakers don't focus their attention on the primary deficit, using that measure to help bridge the political divide and forging bipartisan solutions that will put the government on a fiscally sound and sustainable path. Instead, they bicker over less than meaningful numbers that threaten the U.S.'s standing in the global financial system by way of government shutdowns and reckless talk of not raising America's borrowing capacity, a move that would risk a catastrophic default. Why does it make economic sense to focus on the primary deficit, which ignores federal interest payments? The answer is because tax revenue and interest rates can diverge, often with unexpected results. For example, a booming economy will increase tax revenue but also push up borrowing costs. A slowing economy would have the opposite effect on rates. Think back to the early 1980s. The budget and primary deficits were a similar percentage of gross domestic product as today, and concern about the nation's fiscal situation also was elevated. In 1983, the primary and headline deficits were 3.3% and 5.7% of GDP, compared with 3.8% and 5.4% currently. And like now, the U.S. was also emerging from a painful recession, during which GDP contracted faster and deeper than any time since the Great Depression, only to begin a strong recovery that lasted 6 years, increasing government revenue. As a result, that primary deficit of 3.3% in 1983 became a primary surplus of 0.3% by 1989. But total debt as a percentage of GDP was little changed, going from 38.9% of GDP to 38.5% as the rapidly growing economy kept interest rates relatively high. Federal interest payments grew as a percentage of the economy from 2.5% of GDP in 1983 to 3% in 1989. As a result, the headline deficit in 1989 was 2.7% of GDP, much higher than the post-war average of 1.2% of GDP at the time. If you had judged the country's fiscal health based on the headline deficit alone, you would have thought the U.S. went from the worst shape since World War II in 1983 to merely bad shape in 1989. In fact, America's fiscal health had stabilized, debt was no longer growing as a percentage of GDP, and the stage had been set for the massive surpluses of the 1990s. Similarly, the primary deficit is likely a more accurate measure of U.S. fiscal health today. The bipartisan Congressional Budget Office projects that the primary deficit will come in at a 2.3% of GDP this year and shrink to 2.1% by the year 2034, which is a very manageable figure from a debt management perspective. As for the headline deficit, the CBO projects that to be 5.3% of GDP this year, expanding to 6.2% by the year 2034. Just like in the 1980s, the headline deficit may prove to be an unreliable indicator. The economy has rebounded strongly following the early days of the pandemic. Rising interest expenses rather than increases in government spending are mostly why the headline deficit is wider today than in the year 2019. This is not to say that rising federal interest payments aren't a burden on government finances, and at 2.8% of GDP, they are closing in on their peak of 3% in the year 1995. The upside is that indicators of the U.S.'s ability to pay its $34 trillion of debt, such as robust demand for Treasury securities by foreign investors and a strong and stable dollar, suggest that America's creditors are not worried. Moreover, the CBO is bad at forecasting interest rates. Over the last 40 years, interest payments have been half of what it forecasted on average. That suggests their current projection of interest payments is likely overly pessimistic. Lawmakers should look to the primary deficit to gauge the nation's fiscal health. This measure indicates that while not perfect, the country's fiscal health is better than before the pandemic. What's more, the economy has grown faster than most forecasts. The U.S. could be on the cusp of a repeat of the 1980s when rapidly growing revenues brought the primary deficit swiftly into balance.
Thank you, Scott. I'm going to read this one here. It's kind of short. What a doctor sees when the president hesitates. It's on the opinion page. It's written by Daniel Stone, an internist and geriatrician in Beverly Hills. He wrote this for the LA Times. As a geriatrician, I discuss the effects of aging with patients every day. I wish I had a chance to give my usual talk to everyone who chortles or tears their hair out about President Joe Biden's fitness for his job. Three components of memory should be considered. One is formation, then storage, and finally recall. The most common issue among seniors is slow recall. This is the familiar tip-of-the-tongue phenomenon when a word seems to hide or a name won't come to mind. Given time, it usually arrives. This problem, called age as associated memory impairment, often starts for people in their 30s, gradually progresses. It's a nuisance, but not disabling. If, like me, you find yourself using the term whatchamacallit, you probably have it. Don't worry, you'll be fine. Alzheimer's disease, the most common cause of dementia, is different. Those affected lose the ability to store new memories. They can still access old memories in their memory bank and may recount events that occurred decades ago, but they can't tell you what they had for breakfast because that never entered the memory bank. I reassure my patients with age-associated memory impairment by asking whether they remember their breakfast. They do. Alzheimer's is cognitively crippling. Losing the ability to form new memories freezes one in time. Those affected can't make new friends or address new situations without fresh memories. Additionally, the disease progressively impairs other domains, including behavior and ultimately physical skills. Fortunately, President Biden shows no signs of Alzheimer's disease. At news conferences, he references new events and obviously creates new memories efficiently. He speaks slowly and pauses to find words like others will benign age associated memory impairment. These issues are exacerbated by a chronic speech impediment. Biden has struggled with stuttering since childhood, and remnants of the condition have long been apparent in his speech. Unfortunately, word hesitations coupled up with the mild stutter can't help but affect his public speaking. Biden's political opponents exploit it with stereotypes about older people to create a false narrative about intellectual impairment. I take care of many high-functioning seniors like Biden in my practice. One that I know who is not a patient of mine has been my family's lawyer for 5 decades. Melvin Spears, 96 years old, recently responded to an emailed legal question with succinct and well-targeted advice, as he always has. When I spoke to him, he acknowledged some concessions to his age. He speaks more slowly, and transportation is a challenge because he stopped driving. Studies show that high-functioning seniors like Spears and the president compensate for slower reaction time by applying superior knowledge and judgment. The president is not a job that requires lightning-quick reflexes. Actuarial tables show that the 81-year-old president's life expectancy extends nearly 8 years, well beyond a second term. He gets excellent health care, has no major chronic illnesses, and at his recent physical at Walter Reed Military Medical Center, he was declared healthy, active, and fit for duty. All that means Biden is likely to beat the actuarial estimate. Given his overall health and the absence of current cognitive impairment, he would likely complete a second term with stable cognition. If the American people disagree with President Biden's policies and prefer change, they should support his opponent. But in the absence of valid evidence of true cognitive impairment, their judgment should not be influenced by ageist social stereotypes. Biden and the American political process deserve better.
Now it's time to move on to sports, and here's what's on TV today. In men's college basketball at 1 p.m., we've got the ACC tournament on the ACC network, Georgia Tech versus Notre Dame. 3:30 p.m. on the ACC network, another ACC tourney game, Louisville at North Carolina State. 4 p.m. on ESPN2 in the American East Conference, it's New Hampshire versus Vermont. 5:30 p.m. on ESPNU, it's the Southland Tournament, McNeese State versus a team to be determined. 6 p.m. on the ACC Network in the ACC Tourney, it's Miami versus Boston College. 6 p.m. on CBS Sports Network in Coastal Athletics Conference Championship. 6 p.m. on ESPN, it's the Horizon League Championship. And 6 p.m. on ESPN2, it's the Northeast Conference Championship. 7:30 p.m. on ESPNU, it's the Big Sky Tournament semifinal game. 8 p.m. on ESPN, it's the West Coast Conference Championship. 8:30 p.m. on CBS Sports Network, it's the Summit League Tournament Championship. And at 10 p.m. on ESPN2, it's a Big Sky semifinal game. College women's basketball at 3 p.m. on ESPNU, it's the West Coast Championship. 3:30 p.m. on the CBS Sports Network, it's the Summit League Championship. And at 8 p.m. on ESPN2, it's the Big 12 Championship, which Iowa State will be playing in. NBA, 6:30 p.m., Philadelphia at New York on TNT. 9 p.m. on TNT, it's Minnesota at the L.A. Clippers. And in the National Hockey League, 7:30 p.m., it's Anaheim at Chicago on the NBC Sports Channel.
Thank you, Scott. Here's an article on the Associated Press. There's a picture here of Audie Crooks, who had 25 points in Iowa State's 85-68 win over Oklahoma in the Big 12 tournament semifinals on Monday in Kansas City. The dateline is Kansas City. Audie Crooks, 25 points. Addie Brown added 16, and four-seeded Iowa State romped to an 85-68 victory over top-seeded and number 19 Oklahoma on Monday, giving the Cyclones a chance to defend their women's Big 12 tournament title. Emily Ryan added 12 points and 10 assists for the Cyclones, 20-10, who beat the Sooners in last year's semifinals before topping Texas for the title. Iowa State will now get a rematch Tuesday night, tonight, against the number 6 Longhorns, who beat Kansas State in their semifinal later in the day. Peyton Verhoost had 23 points for the Sooners, 22-9, who will head to the SEC next season, having lost their last 7 Big 12 semifinals. Sahara Williams added 16 points, and league co-player of the year, Skylar Van, finished with 12. Iowa State overcame 21 turnovers by shooting 12 of 23 from the three-point arc. Cyclone set the tone with Crooks in the paint early on. She had 11 points in the first half, and that opened things up from the perimeter, where they drilled 7 of those three-pointers in the first half while building a 38-24 advantage. It was the biggest halftime deficit cold shooting Oklahoma had faced all season, but unlike earlier this season when the Sooners raced from the locker room and used a big second half to win easily in Ames, the Cyclones kept momentum on their side. They outscored Big 12 Coach of the Year Jenny Baranczyk, I might have pronounced that wrong, team 14-3, to start the second half, pushing their lead to 62-43 by the time the fourth quarter rolled around. In fact, Iowa State's only misstep came when Ryan missed a free throw, snapping her streak of 34 consecutive makes. The Cyclones rolled from there into the championship game against the Longhorns. Scott?
In other women's college basketball news, South Carolina still number 1, Iowa up to number 2. Southern California rode a Pac-12 tournament championship to its best ranking in 38 years. The Trojans moved up to number 3 in the AP Top 25 women's basketball poll Monday after topping Stanford to win the conference tournament for the first time since 2014, their only other time in the title game. It's the highest ranking for USC since the final poll of the 1986 season when the team was also 3rd. South Carolina remained a unanimous number 1, receiving all 35 first-place votes from the AP National Media Panel. The Gamecocks head into the NCAA tournament undefeated for the 2nd consecutive season after surviving the SEC tournament semifinals on a last-second three-pointer by Camila Cardoso. The Gamecocks then beat LSU for the title in a game marred by late ejections. Iowa moved back up to number 2 after winning the Big Ten tournament, rallying to beat Nebraska in overtime behind Caitlin Clark. It was the 3rd straight conference tournament title for the Hawkeyes. Stanford fell 2 spots to 4th, and Texas was 5th. UCLA, Ohio State, and LSU followed the Longhorns. ACC tournament champion Notre Dame climbed 5 spots to 9th, and UConn was 10th. Number 25 Fairfield, which entered the poll last week for the first time in school history, has the 2nd longest winning streak in the country at 26 in a row. The Stags capped off a 20-0 regular season in the Metro Atlantic Athletic Conference, becoming only the 8th school to do that in league history. The Stags play in the quarterfinals of the conference tournament on Wednesday. Jackson State received a vote in the top 25 for the 2nd straight week. The Tigers have won 18 straight games and finished off an 18-0 record in the regular season in the SWAC with a win over Mississippi Valley State on Saturday. They opened their league tournament against Prairie View A&M on Wednesday. Nebraska is just outside the top 25 after its close loss to Iowa, a team it beat during the regular season. The Cornhuskers, who had no votes the previous week, were last ranked in 2022. Nebraska received a few votes a couple of times over the course of the season. And the Pac-12 capped off its run as a conference, with 3 of the top 6 teams in the poll and 6 ranked in the top 25 overall. The ACC is next with 5 teams. The Big 12 has 4 and the Big 10 3. The SEC and Big East each have two. The West Coast and Mountain West join the MAC with one team each.
And Niehaus excelled in key role for Quad City Blues. Just a brief comment on him. Moline High product earned All-Star First Team honors. This is written by Samir Mala. Quad City Storm is not the only hockey team in the Quad Cities. The Quad City Blues, a high school team composed of players from around the area in the Midwest High School Hockey League, just wrapped up a banner season, reaching the playoffs for the first time since 2019 and only its second postseason appearance since 2010. Moline High School senior John Niehaus was a major factor in the Blues' success, finishing third among defensive men and the team leader in assists, 35. Niehaus, a team captain, also is first all-time in assists among Blues defensive men, dating back to 2003. For his efforts, Niehaus was named to the All-American All-Star First Team. Niehaus knows where his future is. After graduating from Moline, he'll be attending the United States Military Academy at West Point. He says, "While it is a military college, I want to graduate with a four-year degree. I want to graduate as an officer, and I want the opportunities that they bring out there. I just feel the need to serve our country and just felt a calling to do just that," end quote. So, folks, that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Doug Kretzinger. My partner at the microphone has been the great Scott Splavik. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. I want to thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service, and I want to hope you have and wish you all a very good day.